From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Saturday Fight Night has taken a strange turn in America. Instead of man versus man, dog versus dog in many communities is now the headline act. Across the country, a soaring number of pit bull owners are training their dogs to fight, and fight to the death if necessary. An estimated 40,000 doggers in the U.S. are now involved in a so-called sport that's a felony in 46 states. Shane DeBow is a writer who went inside dog fighting, the murky world of fighting dogs and their trainers. His journey took him to Indiana, where he sat on sagging living room couches with pit bull owners and heard their stories of dreams and despair, sat on front stoops with Don King-like dogfight promoters and watched the deals go down, went into dank basements for a ringside seat to canine carnage. DeBow emerged with a stunning and complex story entitled Dog Bites Dog that appeared in Sunday's New York Times Magazine. The illicit dogfighting culture, he wrote, breeds dreams that any pit bull could be the one to pull its owner out of ghetto poverty and into the big time. What does the epidemic of dogfighting say about American culture today, about aggression and masculinity and frustration? Is dogfighting just one bloody end of a continuum for a society that breeds violence in sports and entertainment? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Chicago is Shane DeBow. Good evening and welcome, Shane DeBow. Terrific story in the New York Times Sunday Magazine.
Thanks so much.
The detail that you brought to the fore there was just mind-boggling. But before we get into that, please describe for us, if you would, the general universe that this dogfighting is taking shape in. You say that it's moved from a once provincial pastime to become an urban epidemic. What's the shape of the dogfighting world? What's the structure?
If you talk to the kind of animal rights folks and the Humane Society, they talk about three different levels of dog fighters: the kind of street level, and then the hobbyist level, and then sort of the big time. And the boundaries are kind of fuzzy, but the street is sort of maybe kids and junior level gangbangers on the corner. They probably don't know that much about their animals or training them or conditioning them. They just pick any dog they can find and they throw it on another dog.
So they do have the idea of fighting, but it's not much more formal than that.
Yeah, it's pretty simple-minded. And then the hobbyists, I think, know a bunch about dogs, about training dogs, about fixing dogs when they're hurt, feeding dogs, all kinds of things, but maybe don't have the capital to really invest or the space to have a big yard. Mm-hmm. And then there's the high-end guys who might have hundreds of dogs in multiple states and might fly around the world to dogfights.
And that's not just fairy tales? There really are such people who have hundreds of dogs and international dogfighting lives?
I didn't have access to those people. That's what I was told. And there's certainly, there's hundreds and hundreds of websites. And if you troll through them, you'll hear accounts of famous fights and big fights in, exotic places. I got a call from a trainer who was conditioning a dog for a $100,000 fight in Puerto Rico. And he said that he had access to a fancy gym in Manhattan where he was going to condition the dogs in the high altitude chamber on a treadmill, and the dog had its own chiropractor, and he was going to swim it, and it was pretty incredible.
So the stories of this top tier, wherever it is, of dogfighting excite interest and followers even down just on the very, very humble back streets that you saw. What does dog conditioning mean, and what is a dog fight exactly, Shane DeBow? How does it work?
The conditioning, and actually that's an important word, because the doggers themselves would never say training. They would say you can't train a dog to fight. It either wants to fight or it doesn't want to fight. Mm-hmm. What you can do is take a dog that wants to fight and give it more stamina or more power or more muscle. And that's what they do. They find dogs, by what's called game testing them, and that's sort of doing mock fights, sort of the equivalent of sparring. Mm-hmm. And when they do these game tests, they will see if the dog wants to be a fighter. And if it doesn't, any one of a number of things can happen. They can just kill it or cull it. They might sell it. They might give it away. But it's really of no use to them, and they don't have a lot of respect for those kinds of dogs, dogs that are not game.
And I know that dogs, you yourself are a pit bull owner, and so I know that, in your view, not every dog falls into this category of fighting dog or fierce dog, even a pit bull.
Yeah, definitely. I had never had a pit bull till a few years ago, just turns out to be a really wonderful breed of dog, very very people friendly. And in fact, an important point probably for people to get is that as a breed, they're probably less people aggressive than most breeds. And I think the reason that there's so many misconceptions about that is because, of course, when they do bite someone, the consequences are a lot greater than if you get bit by a chihuahua versus a pit bull.
But once they're bred for fighting and conditioned to fight and they're in the ring, what is a dog fight?
Dog fight is, if you think of a boxing match, the dogs will start in opposite corners, and the ring generally consists of plywood walls, maybe 2 feet high. And it's maybe 14 feet corner to corner. I don't know if that's comparable to a box ring. It's about the same size. There'll be a handler with each dog, and there'll be a ref in the middle. And the ref will say something to the effect of go, and the handlers will release their dogs. They'll fight. And, throughout the contest, there will be things that are called turns, which is when one dog looks to turn away and quit. And when something like that happens, the ref will call a turn, and the handlers swoop in and they grab their dogs by the scruff of the neck and they drag them back to the corners, and they'll get like a 10-second rest, and then the dog that turned will be responsible for crossing what's called a scratch line, which is just a line in front of the dog's corner, sort of proving that the dog is still willing to fight. It
has to back out.
It has to charge back out and go after the other dog.
How much blood? How much death?
The fights that I saw live, I saw some on videotape as well. The fights that I saw live were not that bloody, and certainly no dogs died. I saw some pretty grim fights on tape with dogs getting their legs broke and eyes popped out, and it's hard to watch.
But you say this quality of game is what the dog fighters, even if they're not anywhere near the top tier, what they so like. You say, it's the competitive heart of the dog that they want to be associated with, its noble trait. You say, indeed, this is a guy that you followed. In Dee's eyes, these dogs are indomitable survivors just like him. Their battles are heroically intense, as are his own battles with poverty, fatherhood, and a legal system at work to lock him up for drinking too much. So the men's person, and it is men, I guess, by and large, their personalities, their egos are invested in the dog in the fight?
Yeah, and that idea of gameness really has a lot of resonance. I mean, it's basically the prime thing that a dogger cares about, and gameness is just the degree to which your dog is not a quitter. And I think a lot of that idea is kind of they want to associate it with it because they don't want to be quitters in their own life. And so they take that trait and kind of wear it themselves.
Schindebaugh, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Toby Miller. He's professor of cultural studies at New York University. Good evening and welcome, Toby Miller. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Toby Miller, Schindebaugh, in his great piece in The Times, quotes a Chicago policeman saying that dogfighting is now the preferred entertainment for the American underclass. He describes it as an urban epidemic. What's going on here in cultural terms that would be driving this? We know dogfighting isn't new. It's been around for centuries, maybe forever. But why now? Why rising in America?
Well, this is obviously an interpretation from someone who's not out there in the field, which Shane is, so I defer to him. But one way of looking at it would be this. First of all, I think we're seeing a situation in a lot of inner-city environments where for a lot of African-American men and some Hispanic men, the dog is actually a weapon. It's a method of defense in the same way that other forms of weaponry are used. So the dog is not just an object you might use in a fight. It's also something that is a sign of your power.
But it's illegal to have and legal to be accompanied by. It's not like a shotgun.
Exactly. It's something you can have around you that everyone can see and that also will protect you. A second thing would be to say that if you look at most of the major sports spectacles that we have and the major violence spectacles, whether you're talking about the Super Bowl or you're talking about violence in an action-adventure Hollywood film, these are very much the domain of corporate players. There isn't much room for the guy on the street corner, whereas the dog area is although, as Shane rightly says, there's a high end to it with high rollers all over the world, mm-hmm. it's pretty much a domain where the informal economy, the illegal economy, can operate,
so do
where
you,
a guy can make a lot of money.
Do you see then a continuum somehow, Toby Miller, between the CEO's skybox at the NFL game or the hockey game down through world pro wrestling right on down to the bloody basement where the dogfight is? Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely, and I think we can see this as a kind of leftover of the days when most sports didn't have, you know, governing rules, didn't have television to control them, didn't have the state involved, the government involved in saying how they should be run, didn't have official bodies that were, you know, like Major League Baseball or Major League Soccer, you know, set up to control them, and instead were quite violent affairs where people died, often where animals were used as objects of struggle and so on. In a way, it's a leftover of what we've seen over centuries and centuries right around the world.
But we've seen reports here that since the late 90s, there's a real spike up. So in one sense, dogfighting has always been around and been with us. In another sense, we're being told by Shane DeBow and others that he quotes that it's really on the rise. How do you interpret that in terms of, I don't know, the American economy, American culture, American aggression, masculinity?
I think you've hit the nail on the head by talking about masculinity. Obviously, this is something that connects very deeply to links between maleness and violence. I was talking only tonight to a woman who'd been the only woman at a cockfight recently, for example. And she said that quite apart from what she might or might not have felt about seeing the cocks fighting, the way the men in the audience and the men who owned the cocks were talking and screaming at one another made her as a woman feel extremely threatened and frightened. And she was thinking about, if you like, the way they were demeaning the animals as being how they might demean her. So I think there's something in here about trying to retrieve a sense of force, of power, of control. I mean, we just heard from Shane about the idea of being game, right, of being able to cope and
never deal. Giving up, always charging out of your corner.
Exactly, being somebody who can't be put down. You know, there's that great line in Raging Bull where Robert De Niro says, "You never put me down," right? You keep on fighting. And I think given what the war on African-American masculinity across the country by the police forces and other institutions has taken away opportunities for so many black men, this is one area. One of the several areas, you know, rap music has been another, basketball another, and so on, where there can be an assertion of autonomy, of power, of strength.
But Toby Miller, hold that thought. Shane DeBow, I didn't get the sense in your reporting of a racial theme here. I think I saw, you know, white, black, Hispanic. I think I saw just about everything represented there.
The guys that I hung out with the most were white.
Is that because you're white, or that's because why?
I mean, it seems to jump, you know, there doesn't seem to be specific to one race or even one class. I mean, it seems to be a pretty wide spectrum.
Are you saying you've got middle-class homeowners with dogfights in their indoor-outdoor carpeted basements?
Yeah, I mean, I had a lot of contacts
really?
That actually flaked out, you know, as I was reporting the story, people I thought were going to be the subject of the story. And they were everything from, you know, there was a video store clerk at a kind of very artsy video store to a contractor with a, you know, a major home building business.
Wow. Toby Miller, let me ask you, how do you factor that into your view of this?
If we're
not just talking underprivileged people here necessarily.
Right. No, absolutely. I take the point. And I think Shay made a good point about in saying that there are these different strata, right? One strata he didn't really get to, which is right at the top. I was saying that I think in terms of some of my informants in the black urban community, there's a specificity to their experience that's relevant here to their way of doing this. But of course, there's something across masculinity that's really relevant. I mean, that's why it's mostly a male audience to the National Football League. Mm-hmm. Men like to see violent encounters between other men. It's part of asserting masculinity and power and strength. And in this country often, as in many countries in Southeast Asia where there's still a lot of interest in dogfighting and especially cockfighting, this is about saying men are not completely under the control of government. The government says, you know, we have a lock on violence, right? We're the ones, we're the state that has the army, that has the police force, that has the navy.
And the people say, oh, no, you don't. Toby Miller, stand by. I want to bring you back for one more question. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about the world of fighting dogs, about the booming new arena of American gambling and American aggression. What is it in American culture that leads more and more Americans to breed and fight fighting dogs? What is the fascination, the obsession with pit bulls? that will fight until they die. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the American world of fighting dogs, the booming new arena of gambling and aggression in this country. We're inspired by a piece in the New York Sunday Times Magazine by Chicago writer Shane DeBow, who spent a lot of time among the dog fighting set, and it's more widespread than you might think. He calls it an urban epidemic. We're also joined by Toby Miller, professor of cultural studies at New York University. You can join the conversation as well. What is it in American culture that leads more and more Americans to breed and fight fighting dogs? Have you seen the pit bull chained in the back of the pickup truck? What does it say to you? What does it symbolize? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Toby Miller, I know we just have you for another minute, but what is it in the culture today that is so threatening to masculinity, as you put it just before the break, that American men, some number of them, feel the need to go out and have dogs tear each other to pieces?
Well, I mean, I think there is a threat to masculinity, Tom, and I think it comes from a number of quarters. First of all, there is the long-term effect of deindustrialization, the loss of manufacturing jobs, the restructuring of the agricultural market, the way in which the economy for the traditional male breadwinner has dramatically changed. I think that's one very important factor. Another important factor is a kind of kickback against the successes of feminism and the increasing importance of women in the labor force. These all, in a whole variety of different ways, have led to an environment where we see more and more men responding by a kind of hyper-masculinity, and certainly the attack dog becomes a kind of extension of the frustrated male.
Hyper-masculinity. Toby Miller, I know we have to let you go, but thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
Toby Miller is professor of cultural studies at New York University. Shane DeBow, your piece in the New York Times Sunday Magazine painted such a picture. I wish you'd share it with us. You met several men who were very involved in breeding their dogs. Give us a sense of where they were, what was the neighborhood, what was the setting, how did the family take on board this activity, what was their attitude toward their dogs? Did they treat them like dispensable items, or was there a loving pet relationship here somehow in spite of the violence? Take us into this world.
It's sort of all those things at the same time. Let's see.
This was Indianapolis, is that right?
This was Indianapolis, and there's nothing special about Indianapolis other than that's where I happened to find people that would let me in. I mean, there's certainly, it goes on all over the place. There was plenty of folks I talked to here in Chicago and, you know, all over the country. These guys, the main guy, D, had a family. They both were white guys living in pretty poor black neighborhoods, and at least D in particular was pretty upset about that he had to live there and definitely wanted to get out, and that was part of his thinking. How they treated the dogs, it's very hard to kind of – it was hard for me to wrap my mind around it, because they do, you know, in a way, really love the dogs. At least D did. And how you make the leap between loving the dog and fighting it, I think they would say – is that the dog loves to fight, and so that it would be cruel to not let the dog do what it wants to do.
Have its way is their point. But they're breeding and encouraging the most violent tendencies of these dogs.
Exactly. So it's not really a natural nature at this point. The dog has been bred to be this way. And as I've learned from owning pit bulls, they don't necessarily have to be that way when you own them.
You describe the whole family sitting around on a slouching living room couch watching videotapes of dogfights on a big screen television, the 3-year-old son of Dee standing close enough to touch the giant screen while we watch this slur of gnashing teeth and bloody coats. I mean, is there no sense in the family that this ain't great stuff to be doing and seeing and watching and showing your children?
There really isn't. The dogs are there. The kids are there. There was actually some other dogs that were running through that I didn't get the names of. There were, dogs and kids on the sofa together, sleeping together, really young kids. There was no sense that this was something that the kids should be kept away from, or that this could be somehow, damaging to them down the road. And the culture is just very violent, and I don't think this quite makes the radar like human violence does, which they're kind of immersed in there.
Mm-hmm. You describe how Dee was putting his hopes on a dog named Roxy, took her to a fight, and it didn't work out.
No, he had this dog, and I never got to see the papers, but what I was told about her is that she was supposed to be very very well bred and have very parents that were good fighters.
He paid $3,000 for Roxy?
Yeah, it became unclear whether he had paid cash or traded the equivalent, something equivalent to $3,000. But at any rate, there was some sort of $3,000 was kicked around.
And you write about dogs bringing up to $60,000 for big name fighting dogs.
An animal control worker told me that he had heard about a $60,000 dog, I think being sold to some dog fighters in Japan. A lot of the dogs that are bred in the U.S., when they sell for big money overseas.
Mm-hmm.
But so this dog, Roxy, he was going to test her, the game test, to see if she was going to be a fighter because she was young and she had never been in a pit, you know, where she was asked to fight.
Mm-hmm.
And in her first test, she messed herself. Her bowels went loose and
from fear,
from fear and shock. And she just didn't know what this other dog was doing, attacking her. And to the dog fighters, that meant that she was, you know, sort of unsavable. There was no making a fighter out of a dog that doesn't want to fight.
She wasn't game.
So she became sort of instantly worthless. Yeah, she wasn't game.
And D sold her just as soon as he could and picked up another dog named Tyson.
He either sold her or traded her, and he got this dog Tyson. And Tyson had a really sort of ferocious rep. He had pulled a Cadillac with people in it. I think four. Donnie described them as fat people, so four heavy people, a lot of weight, and he had been in something like 28 fights. These are sort of unofficial fights; no one records them, but he had won all of them, and so he was a terrific fighter. But he didn't have any papers; he had no breeding, so whether or not he could ever sort of be a famous dog is debatable.
Mm-hmm. But D was ready to fight him. You write about the conditioning, and it can be cruel. I don't know, jalapenos stuffed into the dog, a diet of gunpowder to irritate them and make them angry, steroids, eating bait animals, cats and whatnot, cocaine. I mean, does all that really go on? Is that the scroungy end?
It's definitely the scroungy end. It's that most of that probably, although the performance drugs would be at the high end. But, the crueler stuff seems to be on the street level where the people trying to get the dogs ready for a fight really don't know much about how to do it other than to try to make the dog as mean as possible. And those are the dogs, I think, that are probably showing up in the headlines. Those are the dogs that when they get out of the yard, they're going to bite the first thing they see because they're miserable and they've been treated very badly by people. And that's definitely kind of the in-your-face side of the sport.
And you also write about a kind of protocol that surrounds the fights, and these are pretty scrappy fights you observed, but the Cajun rules, the dog owner washes the other owner's dog to be sure the skin isn't poisoned just before the fight?
Yeah, dog fighting, they started bringing these dogs over from the British Isles, I think, in the late 1800s. And so there's a lot of tradition, a lot of kind of rules and techniques and stuff that's been passed down. And one set of rules that is often employed is called the Cajun rules. And it's you can actually find it on the internet, you know, like everything else. And there's 20-some rules and very specific about timekeeping and witnesses and this thing about washing down the other guy's dog in case he's put poison on the coat to hurt your dog.
Mm-hmm.
It's very and I think that's part of what dog fighters like about it, that it is a very specific and secret world, and it sort of unites them in a fraternity. And if you're passionate about this thing that society condemns, here you found these people that don't condemn you for it, and I think you really respond to that feeling of fraternity.
The fraternity and even respect that comes from it. But you quote the Chicago policeman again, saying this is now the preferred entertainment for the American underclass. What a thought. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Barbara's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Barbara. You're on the air.
Hi. I want to talk about one of the negative side effects of all of this very negative publicity about what we call pit bulls.
Mm-hmm.
My son has two dogs that are extremely gentle, well-behaved dogs. And because they are pit bulls, he has actually stopped taking them out during the daytime.
Because people are afraid or?
Well, people yell at him. People yell obscenities at him. People make assumptions about why he has these dogs. about his intentions and about the potential negative behavior of the dogs, and it's just not there.
Why does he have them with a reputation for violence? What draws a person to make a pit bull a pet?
Well, you know, what draws a person to make any animal a pet?
Well, many dogs are known to be, you know, calm or friendly, or, I mean, we don't make crocodiles pets that often. I mean, and I'm not saying they're the same, but do you know what I mean? That is the reputation. So what is it that would, out of all the breeds of dogs, say, I want a pit bull?
Let's put it this way. My son is a biracial young man with medium brown skin.
Mm-hmm.
What about the negative stereotypes associated with being an ethnic or racial minority male in this country? And what do you say about that?
Are you saying that
because these stereotypes exist, should we all buy into them and make assumptions that when you see someone, that because there are headlines all the time about the behavior of this dog or this particular ethnic or racial group, that we should assume that every time you meet one person or one animal, that you are going to be subjected to negative behavior?
No, I take your point. Let's put it to Shane DeBow. Shane, I mean, we're born to our race, but we choose the breed of our pet dogs. Help us understand pit bulls here and the attraction of owning a pit bull as opposed to any other kind of dog. And by the way, you point out this is more than one species that falls under this, or more than one type, breed that falls under this general label.
Yeah, it gets pretty fuzzy. Even talking to dog fighters, people seem pretty confused. And I think the easiest way to think about it is there's several different types of dogs that share some common blocky build characteristics, and it's, let's call them all pit bulls for now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the experts may disagree, but for our purposes.
Why do you own one? Are you a closet would-be dog fighter? Does it supplement your sense of masculinity? Or is it simply something about the breed that, despite their reputation, makes you say, I want to have this dog around me all the time?
Yeah, that. They're great dogs. I had a dog before the pit bull came into my life. And when the pit bull came in, she was just terrific and really friendly and really people-friendly. And again, I think that should really be stressed. Like if you like dogs, pit bulls are sort of like, you know, the hyperbole of dog characteristics. They love people. They'll lick your face.
Does she make you feel safer? Is it a matter of protection? Do you feel safer walking down the street with a pit bull?
It's not for me, but I definitely can understand the people that if you want to feel powerful and you walk a pit bull down the street in my neighborhood, which is kind of changing, the rougher parts of the neighborhood, people, you know, tough guys on the corner will still jump on car hoods when you come by if you happen to surprise them.
Mm-hmm.
Or if your dog's off the leash and it's chasing the ball towards them, they'll definitely jump on a car right away.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting, actually, the tougher neighborhoods you go to, the more fearful people are of pit bulls. I mean, it must, you know, obviously they see the bad end of them more often.
So there is a kind of built-in low-cost security system here. Barbara, thanks for your call. Dana's calling from South Wellfleet, Massachusetts. Hi, Dana. You're on the air.
Hi. Good evening.
Evening.
I'd like to open by saying fraternity, tradition, cultural, my foot.
Mm-hmm.
This is vile egotism, which actually cuts into, which goes into a, which is subsumed by a bigger picture of human arrogance.
And, you mean goading dogs to fight and kill one another?
Yeah, it's cruel. I mean, it's exploiting the animal for your own ego. But this is really the extreme end of a spectrum of human arrogance towards other animals. Generally, in the general picture of things, I mean, we human beings tend to think we arrogate ourselves above the other animals.
Mm-hmm.
And until that, I mean, I'm all for law enforcement. I told your screener these people should spend a long time in jail, but the more I've heard tonight about the way these dogs are trained and treated, as far as I'm concerned, human beings like that should die and make the earth a more beautiful place. It's an ecological imperative.
Well, that pushes a limit too. But Danny, you raise a point. And Shane DeBow, let me put it to you: for many, many years, this has been seen along with cockfighting and all kinds of animal fighting as outside the realm of accepted behavior. It is, as we noted at the top of the show, a felony in 46 states. So, what's the state of law enforcement? Dana raises it here. Are there crackdowns? Or is it even pursued? As you describe it, it's almost open and free.
I think it really depends on the community. I mean, if you live in a community that has had one of these horrible maulings, I think you'll probably see some cracking down. Or if you have a particularly zealous individual who really wants to make it his crusade, as the guy in Chicago, Steve Brownstein. I mean, he's just very dedicated, and he really believes that, you know, cracking down on dog fighting and animal abuse is one way to make things better for people. I mean, he really stresses this cycle of violence where people will kind of graduate from animal cruelty to human cruelty.
Mm. You quote him saying, so now you've got these little kids exposed to it, dog fighting, exposed to all this violence, and it's desensitizing. This is now a window into our whole society, into a future where cruelty is condoned. You go to these urban schools, ask fourth graders, who's seen a dog fight? Every hand goes up. This is a Chicago policeman, Steve Brownstein, speaking. That is a disturbing notion, but it would seem that would make dogfighting acceptable to a younger generation of Americans.
Certainly in certain neighborhoods, I think it is. And there's a lot of kind of this trickle-down aspirational thing going on where, you know, there rappers have dogs and pro athletes have pit bulls, and there's a lot of you know, kind of romance to it. I think if you're a young kid growing up in a tough neighborhood and you see the guy with the flashiest car and the biggest gold chain with a real tough dog, and you're like, that's who I want to be, that guy.
So when we see a pit bull in the street, in a car, on the back of a truck, I've seen them chained by two chains on the truck side to side. Is there any way of knowing what's a fighting dog trained to be really violent and what's a pit bull who's not in the racket?
I don't think so. I mean, there's certainly the dogs that are fighters are often very scarred, and that's one thing. But you have to remember, even the dogs that I was meeting that were, you know, fought a lot and were very scarred, most of them, except for a few rare exceptions, were very friendly to people, and you know, you could wrestle with and you could play with, and they would lick you, and you know, they were dogs, you know, like you would have as a pet, except that they do this other thing.
It's pretty incredible. But you're saying that they had to be trained, goaded, and deliberately encouraged to do this thing, to do this fighting.
Again, the word train, the dog fighting community would really quibble with that. Yeah, they would say you can't train a dog to fight. It's either going to want to or not. And when you find one that wants it, you condition it and make it ready to fight and make it able to fight as good as you can. I realize it's hard for people to understand, but the dogs really, they can be completely people friendly and at the same time be very animal aggressive. And that seems to be where people get confused.
Well, yeah, and it's understandable confusion. We're talking tonight about the world of fighting dogs, the booming new arena of American gambling and aggression. Can we draw a trend line from the NFL to the outlandish violence of pro wrestling to fighting pit bulls? Is there an arc of American aggression here? What makes men turn to fighting dogs? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the violent world of fighting dogs, about a booming new arena barely underground of American gambling and aggression. We're talking about an urban epidemic, in the words of our guest tonight, Shane Dubow, who had a terrific story in last Sunday's New York Times Sunday Magazine, Dog Bites Dog. He's a Chicago writer, and with us tonight, you can join as well. What is it in American culture that leads more and more Americans to breed and fight fighting dogs? Is the fighting dog a surrogate for threatened masculinity? And are the dog fights in your town? Are you sure? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Ondine is on the line. Hi, Ondine. You're on the air.
Hi, yes. I'm calling from Jamaica Plain. I have no doubt that there are dog fights in my town. I own a pit bull mix, and I often get admiring glances and questions from young men.
Along the lines of, would you like your dog to have a fight with my dog?
No, more along the lines of, hey, is that a pit bull mix? And people have offered to buy her as well.
So what's going on, do you think, with all this fighting, Undine?
I'm really struck, and I'm really appreciating how intelligently Shane talks about this topic.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really struck by how the men who own these dogs clearly do identify with them. They admire them. But nonetheless, they're able to send them into a ring where they get mauled, possibly killed. And I wonder if there's a connection there between masculine gender identity and how you develop, you know, boys into men by suppressing their compassion.
A kind of tough love notion, Undine?
Yes, exactly. You know, be a man, don't cry, and to some degree don't have any sympathy or compassion. And I think that's very scary in terms of what it indicates about where our culture is going. And actually, I'd like to listen to the comments off on the air.
Great, Undine, and thank you for your question and your call. Shane DeBow, how about this tough love theory? I mean, could that be in some part of this range? But then you also write about losing dogs being set on fire, about jaws being half knocked off with a 2x4. That doesn't sound like any kind of love at all.
Yeah, it's pretty tough to just say it's one way or the other. And I think I'm probably getting out of my depth here with speculating on what happens to kids when they're exposed to this or to young men. But nevertheless,
identity.
I will charge ahead. I think Steve Brownstein would argue that
this is the Chicago police officer.
His argument and you know, a lot of people's argument would be that when kids are exposed to this, violence becomes, you know, normative. And it's not a big deal then to, you know, graduate to being the drive-by shooter when you're 15 and you join the gang.
That you're desensitized, you're pulled into a world of violence, blood, guts, the works.
Yeah, you're desensitized, and you've learned that even with this other living creature that maybe you connected with or had a bond with, you know, your older brother or your father or the uncle down the street or the big man on the block kind of taught you that even though, you know, you cared for this dog, it was fine to beat it up or kill it or punish it for losing a fight.
Wow, it's a tough way to train anything, and if it's training, it's training for an awfully tough life. Gene's calling from Jamaica Plain. Welcome, Gene. You're on the air.
Okay, I haven't heard Shane's comments in the last few minutes of the program, but I heard him at the beginning.
Yes.
And my impression is that he is downplaying the brutality of the owners of these dogs. In order to train the pit bulls, the owners use small, weak dogs and also cats as fodder for the pit bulls. And this is accepted in the neighborhood in Boston where I lived just a few years ago, where I saw a man walking a pit bull around 5:30 in the afternoon, and behind him was the most frightful-looking, maimed and broken and beaten dog I've ever seen. And that it was a smaller dog, and that dog was being used by this man for the pit bull to practice on.
Gene, thank you for your call. We put it to Shane DeBout. Gene hears the violence of this conditioning and fighting being underplayed. In fairness, in your article, you talk about some animals being used as kind of bait or to gin up the excitement of a fighting dog. But are we giving short shrift to just how bloody and bad this can be?
Well, I guess if you haven't read the article, maybe you are, maybe I am, but, no, it definitely, it can be brutal. And I didn't see the bait animals being used, but I was sort of inundated with stories about it. And, it's interesting. The dog fighters defend themselves often by, you know, any criticism you make of them, for example, using bait animals, they will say, that's the street fighters, and those are not the real dog men. And if they were real dog men, they wouldn't do that. Now, you can certainly take issue with that, but that's how they would respond to that. That's one segment of the dog fighting community, and it doesn't speak for all of them.
But then the fight itself is premised on violence. I mean, you described the two dogs going at it, and one latches onto the other's snout, the face hold, there's a sharp crunch. Probably bone or an eye socket or something, the fighter says. I mean, other dogs fighting when their rear legs are nearly torn off. The fight itself is inherently violent, often super violent, is it not?
Yeah, it totally is. It can be really brutal. And the fights I saw on tape were really hard to watch. And again, I would say that the dog fighters would defend themselves, and I'm not trying to defend them for them, but I'm just – since I am representing what they would say here, they would say that the majority of dog fights don't go to the death. And, you know, a fight is often – fight is supposed to be determined when one dog can't leave its corner. Now, that could be because it's scared or it could be because it's injured, but it doesn't have to be dead. And that's sort of how they would respond to the idea that this is always a brutal sport.
You describe the end of that fight where the dog owner calls for his mom, who tromps downstairs with two syringes so that Big M can stab each panting and puncture-flecked dog in the rump with 1.5 cc of penicillin. What an end. Juliet is on the line. Welcome, Juliet. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you doing? I'm calling from Boston, too, from Jamaica Plain.
Good to have you, Juliet.
Thank you. And one of the reasons I was calling was because a few callers ago, I felt like the woman that you were asking, why would you have a pit bull? Why would you have this kind of dog? I felt like she wasn't really answering your question. And I just wanted to make all the points about the dogs that are just so wonderful.
Are you a pit bull owner, Juliet?
Yes. I have an 8-year-old pit bull. And I also have a tiny Italian greyhound and 3 cats, and they all get along perfectly.
But I guess a lot of people who don't own pit bulls would have the sneaking suspicion that all pit bull owners, somewhere in the back of their mind, are aware of the dog's capacity for violence and thinking that just by having it, they're defended or threatening. But is that misguided?
I think that is the misconception that a lot of people have, that they are naturally aggressive or mean or bad dogs. And I agree with the fact that they are strong and powerful dogs. Any dog, if you abuse the dog, neglect the dog, anything like that, can be turned into a mean dog. The difference is with a pit bull, they are very strong and very powerful, and it is true that they can be game. They won't give up. But I think when raised properly, they are the sweetest, most loyal, most people-loving, so great around kids. Like, I will never be without a pit bull. They are the most wonderful dogs, and a lot of people that I know that have pit bulls feel the same way about them.
Well,
they're just like the best companion that you can have.
Point
my
taken.
Dog
but
is so sweet in that way.
We take the point, but I guess once the dog is dragged into the world of fighting, well, you tell us, Shane DeBow, and thank you, Juliet, for your call, but once the dog comes into this world, is it spoiled to any kind of normal life? Is it safe to be around humans that it doesn't know anymore?
Yeah. The case can be made that actually pit bulls are among the most people friendly breeds, and
even after they've come into dog fighting.
Yeah, because there really is a difference between people aggression and animal aggression. It's not just one big lump of aggression, and the dog fighter. You know, you can even from a kind of a breeding perspective, they would say, we've been culling out man biters for dozens of decades because we can't be in the pit with a dog that's going to bite us. Mm. So if a dog shows any aggression towards people as a little dog, if you're a dog fighter that knows your stuff, you cull it out. And the only dogs you raise are dogs that are specifically not people aggressive because you just can't handle it.
And we read the stories. You write finally about the money, and our time is running down here, about the hundreds of millions, you say it's estimated, from stud fees, puppy sales, fight bets, despite some cities banning pit bulls. And the dream of the subject of your article, D, you say he dreams of owning hundreds of dogs. Describe that picture, his dream for us.
He wants to get out of the ghetto and own this sort of bucolic rural property with these lines of dog pens, you know, towards the horizon. And he wants to rescue every pit bull, and he wants to take his kids to play with them. And the thing he said to me was, I want to have so many dogs, I want to have to use a golf cart just to go visit them all.
Shane DeBow, thanks for an incredible insight into a world that many of us never visit. Thanks for your article, thanks for your work, and thanks for writing it up in such illuminating detail.
Thanks, Tom.
Shane DeBow is author of Dog Bites Dog in last Sunday's New York Times Magazine. You can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, what one Gulf War veteran tells his children. This is On Point. In 1991, Charles Sheehan Miles shipped out for Iraq, fighting for America in the first Gulf War. The young soldier drove an army tank across the sands of Iraq and came home a decorated combat veteran. He had an army medal, but he also had unanswered questions. More than a decade later, Sheehan Miles is still searching for answers to those questions for the sake of his children, he says, for the sake of America as it considers another war in Iraq.
I'll never forget the morning of February 27, 1991. As a young U.S. Army tanker near the banks of the Euphrates River, two trucks raced through our position at roughly 2 a.m. We opened fire. One truck carried fuel and splashed its burning cargo on the other, and burning men ran everywhere, only to be met by our machine gun fire. This was the clean, precise Gulf War for me, and those images never left me. One day my growing son or daughter will ask me what I did in the war, and I'll tell them. And they'll have other questions, questions that haunt me, questions we should all be asking. Where were we when our country allowed 1.2 million Iraqis to die of preventable diseases related to the sanctions? Reaping the benefits of the new economy, working for high-tech startups trying to provide a better future for our children? Where were we when 130,000 disabled Gulf War vets fought for help from the government and for years got lies and bureaucratic misdirection? Were we buying our first homes, trading up to a new one, saving for our kids' college? Where were we when Congress legislated away our rights to privacy and due process, huddled with our families, protecting them against terrorists? What about when the president named American citizens enemy combatants and denied them the rights that are guaranteed in the Constitution? Were we too busy worrying about the recession? Were we too busy thinking about the next round of layoffs? Where were we when Congress handed over its constitutional authority to declare war? The Founding Fathers wisely placed that power in the whole body of Congress, yet they are too timid to insist on keeping it. Were we too scared by the propaganda and lies? What if there were terrorists in our neighborhoods? Our children are growing up in a country no longer America, a country where the government can search your house without telling you, a country where your neighbors may be informants, a country where Americans should watch what they say, a country where people are disappeared if they look wrong, talk wrong, or think wrong, a country that dominates world affairs and keeps its citizens scared, a country willing to sacrifice hundreds of thousands of lives over politics, and where the people don't know or care the cost. A country where democracy is controlled by corporations and the rich. You know, I've been pretty busy, and not a lot of time to spend on all those issues. I make pretty good money, I've got a nice house in the suburbs, a minivan, and I'm raising my children with a better standard of living than my parents had. Isn't that the American dream, isn't it? Do you think our children will thank us for their legacy? The Kill the Constitution Coalition quips, "The Constitution is not a suicide pact." They are patently wrong. Our nation's quest for liberty is best typified by Virginian Patrick Henry's exhortation, "Give me liberty or give me death." That is the legacy I would give to my children.
Charles Sheehan Miles, a decorated Gulf War combat veteran, is author of Prayer at Rumaila and former president of the National Gulf War Resource Center. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Alina Mata, Kelly Jones, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skoke, with help from Oliver Reed, Andy Farnsworth, and Michael Garth. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.